Well, hey, welcome to Thoughts We Might Have Had, the podcast. I'm Micah Thompson. With me, per usual, the amazing Jack Gregory.
Woohoo!
I'm here.
How are you doing?
Oh, we're doing pretty good. It's been a little while since we just recently published our first one, but we're back
Indeed.
For more because nobody can get enough of us.
It's true. You surviving this whole daylight savings time thing?
Yes.
I feel like the government sneaking into our houses and stealing an hour is very, very rude. You know,
it's very rude, and it also makes me wonder sort of about the metaphysical implications of it. I mean, you know,
it's true.
Who is it? Is Doctor Who working for the U.S. government and stealing time?
Say, it feels very Doctor Who villainish. Like,
right.
You wonder if there's like a Doctor Who villain stealing time and like storing it up somewhere so that eventually he can age us all by like 40 years and rule the country. This is my This is my personal thesis on daylight.
It's like the angels almost. You know,
true.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little creepy when you think about it.
It really
Although
is.
Supposedly, and this is just a rumor that I heard. Arizona doesn't do daylight savings time.
Oh, interesting. So they're like rebellious sitting on the fringe.
Yeah,
huh?
It's like, right, yeah.
Man, you know, that's crazy.
Don't tread on me kind of, you know.
Exactly. Well, see, we never did daylight savings time in Guam, but that's because the sun rose at 6 and set at 6 all year.
Right, because you're like right there on the equator, and so there's, yeah, it's constantly the whole, yeah.
Exactly. It was great. So when I came to America for college, and people are like, oh, by the way, tonight you got an extra hour of sleep because the government loves you and wants to give you an hour to sleep. It was like, oh, that's awesome. That's okay. And then, you know, a few months later, they're like, oh, tonight you lose an hour of sleep because the government hates you and wants you to be tired and draggy all week long. And I just think it's very mean of the government to do that.
Yeah.
To just mess with my sleep schedule. I feel like if they're going to do that, they should just make Monday a holiday.
That's
like,
an excellent
idea.
We
have enough weird holidays in this country, like President's Day and Cow Appreciation Day, and, you know, all there's some weird holidays. You think we could have one for day after Daylight Savings Time's Day? Because it's only fair.
It really is. And if, you know, if they're going to do things like, you know, steal from us in a borderline intangible manner, they should compensate us in some way.
I agree. I completely agree with you. Or either a holiday or paying, like just, you know, here's $5 for that hour that we took away from you.
Yeah,
which I realize
that'd be
great our government too. Does not have a surplus of money. So maybe the holiday thing would work out better.
Yeah.
Though I did hear this year, I heard that there's actually a petition to make the day after the Super Bowl a holiday.
Really?
And
anything
it has,
that
like,
gets us
it
more
has,
federal
like,
holidays, I'm a fan of. Because, I mean, you know, taken as a whole, Americans work more hours, take less vacation and are less satisfied with their lives than the majority of the, you know, most advanced countries in the world.
It's true. It's true. I have heard that before.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the answer. Like, maybe we need the day after the Super Bowl, day after daylight savings time, and we just need to take those holidays, come up with some arbitrary reason, like, you know, National Save the Forest Day. Or maybe National, maybe like Un Arbor Day. Like, we could have a day I set aside for the year to go out and chop down a tree.
Okay, right. Yeah.
Or
I
a
mean,
shrub.
You know,
like, maybe National Anti-Shrub
Like,
day.
Hedge trimming day.
Exactly. You just go out and you hack a shrub down, and then you come inside and you light it on fire, and it's a big family event. It would be great.
Yes, right.
There you go. That's it.
Yeah, okay.
National Hack a Shrub Day, after Daylight Savings Time Day, a day to recover, to chop down a bush. It's great.
Yes. Write your senators. Make
Absolutely.
Sure that this becomes part of the next congressional
sign
season.
Us on the bottom of it, like,
exactly.
You know, brought to you by thoughtswemighthavehad.com. It'll be great. It'll be awesome. So there you go. That was not planned at all, but we talked about it. So it's a win. It's a win. All right. First on the docket today, I think, let's talk about, for those of you who don't know, January and February and at least the first part of March are like dead zones for good movies.
It
like,
really is.
Nothing comes out good. In those time, like, we're just getting out of it. Oz the Great and Powerful or whatever just came out, and supposedly that's kind of good. I haven't watched it. But other than that, like, there's been nothing good out. So let's
right.
go.
Right, it's
let's...
that sort of, we're having the Academy Awards. Let's not
right.
take anybody's attention off of last year's movies.
Right.
Let's focus on last year's movies so we can't release anything good now because
right.
that would divert the attention, etc. So,
exactly.
they, yeah.
It's very sad. Let's go back. Let's jump back a little bit to sort of the last good movies to come out. Let's talk about The Hobbit, which is
Excellent
very
movie.
Interesting. And let's talk about Les Mis, which was also Very interesting. Yeah, it's funny. All right, so The Hobbit. Go. What'd you like? What'd you not like?
All right. Here's what I like about The Hobbit. You know, we all, at least if you had any measure of a heart, a soul, or a brain in the last 10 years, we all watched the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Right. And we all loved it.
We did.
And, you know, and then finally Return of the King came out and it brought this, you know, amazing story arc to a close and finally won some Academy Awards and blah, blah, blah. You know, and it was, you know, it was a meaningful, emotional, fantastic journey.
That's
and
probably then... the closest I've ever come to crying in a movie was Return of the King. The end of Return of the King really reached me. I probably would have cried, but it was like a 3-hour-long movie and I had drunk a huge drink, so I really had to go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
But barring a very full, near to bursting bladder, I probably would have cried, but I did not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then, and so that's over, and we have this long hiatus. And through that, you know, there's rumors, oh, they're going to make The Hobbit. Guillermo del Toro's directing it. Peter Jackson's directing it. Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And then they finally make the first one. And it comes back, and it's like coming home. Almost in a sense, you know, because it's like, oh my gosh, we're back where we spent that amazing ride before, and we're here again, and we're getting new stuff. And but there was that sense of returning, which was great, and I loved that they were able to maintain that.
Right.
I also love the fact that Lord of the Rings was very, you know, Men of the West, you know, the fading away of the elves. It was elves and man and hobbit centered.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, we get dwarves.
It's true.
And of the standard fantasy races, I love the dwarves. The dwarves have always been kind of awesome. You know, there's
and they're
the whole...
very underappreciated.
They're very underappreciated.
Nobody,
you know,
likes
it...
dwarves.
Right. And I think it's because, you know, they tend to be a little caricatured. You know, hey, I've got a huge beard and I drink a lot of alcohol. You know, I mean, that's, you know, and
which all of the dwarves in this movie did, consequently.
Right. You know, and that is part of being a dwarf, but that is not all of being a dwarf, you know, and so I like the fact that they dig into the dwarvish culture and show us, you know, sort of the depth of history and the significance there, and a lot of the visual aspects, you know, the elves, well, the elves were all very, you know, ooh, in touch with nature, very smooth and flexible and kind of, you know, and men are just like, well, we're men, rah, you know, and we ride horses and we have spears and swords, you know, but
and
dwarves are
beards
are,
and wet hair for reasons that no one is ever clear on.
Exactly, you know, but we never wash it, right? You know, and but the dwarves, you know, they've got their own feel to them, and I like that they were able to explore some of that. The music in The Hobbit was fantastic too. There was that sense of familiarity, but they had new themes, and it was very appropriately well designed music. And to be quite honest, it felt Lord of the Ringsy. You know, there was that kind of epic sweep to it, but, you know, they have the comedic bits in there. Some people think they went a little overboard on the comedic bits, but, you know, hey, that's a personal preference. You can make that judgment call for yourself. And, of course, the casting was absolutely incredible.
Oh, right.
Richard Armitage's Thorin is the first one that comes to my mind, but also, you know, Martin Freeman as Bilbo.
Martin Freeman was great.
Right, Martin Freeman was fantastic, you know, and obviously, of course, they had to bring Sir Ian McKellen back as Gandalf because he was, you know, the iconic character for me in the first trilogy, and having him back was just wonderful to see the man back on screen.
Right. Okay. Well, that's great. Yeah, I agree. I really liked it. I agree that it was like coming home because there was all the positive, oh, it's so good to see you again. There's also sort of the underlying sort of, oh, you're too skinny, or... did you pierce your ear? Or there's all this sort of weird, I don't know about this. It was like coming home from college because everyone is really glad to see you. But there's sort of this underlying thing of, oh my goodness, you cut your hair so short. You know?
Right, things are different now. Things have changed.
Right. Because, like, you know, you talked about a lot of the positives, and I agree. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. But the two big things that kind of stuck out for me, negativity side, because, you know, one of us is the good cop, I'm the bad cop in this case. I thought that the physical stuff, like the comedy, was a little overdone sometimes. Like the whole thing with the dwarves in the mine, where they are apparently just immune to fall damage. Like they're like falling down cliffs and landing, and trolls and beams and star destroyers are landing on top of them, and they're like, and they just keep going. It was ridiculous.
I have, like, unintelligible grunt shielding.
Right. They're just, like, bouncy. Like, you get the feeling that these dwarves are made of flubber. And it's just, like,
right. We are all gummy bears.
Exactly. So there was that, which didn't bother me too much. But it was, you know, because I understand The Hobbit really does. Like, if you read The Hobbit and then you read The Lord of the Rings, they're very different. Like, The Hobbit is more of a kid's book. It's like reading the first book of Harry Potter and then jumping to the seventh
book.
That's
a very good parallel, yes.
Because the first book is a kid's book, and the seventh book is not.
Nope.
So it's like that. It's like The Hobbit was very sort of a kid's book, and The Lord of the Rings, they're still, you know, they're not scary too much, but, you know, they're deeper. They're big.
Mm-hmm.
So I was okay with it. The only thing that I really hated about the movie was the other wizard, Radagast
the Brown.
I just felt like he's like the Jar Jar Binks of The Hobbit. Like, this big, over-the-top character who didn't really serve a narrative purpose. He was just sort of around. Like, I was okay with the first part where he was, like, in Mirkwood, and it was like, oh, something dangerous is happening. But then it really felt like the second time he came in with the rabbits and the sled that he was really just around because we felt like we needed to laugh at something at that point.
Right. They're writing the script, and they're like, all right, and at this point on our standard format, we need some comic relief.
Exactly.
What could we do? I know. Rabbits pulling a sled.
Exactly. So that was too much for me. Like, that at that point, I was just like, okay, I feel we've taken this way too far. But I understood. Once again, I understood what they were doing. I was okay with the movie on the whole. I enjoyed it. I had fun. But yeah, those are my two only really qualms I had. So I agree. It's like coming home from school where everyone is glad to see you, but your mother does not approve of your hair length and your dad doesn't like the fact that you pierced your nose. You know,
right.
It's just a mixed sort of.
And your one friend that you thought was going to be there hasn't gotten back yet,
exactly.
Or isn't coming back because they are dating somebody in another state,
right.
Or something,
right.
Like that. Which in this case would have been the overall absence of Benedict Cumberbatch from the movie.
It's true. Benedict Cumberbatch is in this movie, and he wasn't around.
Right.
Like,
at the very end
of the movie, Smaug like opens his eye, and that was it.
Right. Which technically wasn't Benedict Cumberbatch. That was all CGI.
Right. You know, but he's the voice of the dragon.
Yes, he's the voice of the dragon, and he's the voice in the motion capture for the necromancer, which in this case is a slightly dark shape in a ruined castle that you see for about half of a second. You know, so it's like, okay, yeah, they credited him, but I was really hoping we would get more of that.
Yeah, it just reminded me of that Dr. Manhattan from Walkman or Watchmen.
Yes.
It was like this outline of a guy. It's like, oh, it's Dr. Manhattan.
Hey, look at him there. Okay, that's awkward. Right.
So anyway.
You know, hey, Benedict Cumberbatch will, I'm sure, be in the second one. And we're also getting Star Trek Into Darkness. So we will see the man eventually. And we're holding out hope for another amazing performance because the guy is absolutely incredible.
Right. Here's my question in regards to The Hobbit 2, Desolation of Smaug, I believe
yes.
it is called. Do they kill off Smaug in the second movie? Don't you kind of have to?
Well, here's the thing. If you follow the storyline of The Hobbit, there's basically several turning points in the plot.
Right.
They get captured in Mirkwood by the wood elves, basically.
Uh-huh.
And that's a big, like, oh, you know, plot twist changer.
Right, which then, you figure takes half hour, 45 minutes.
Right, and then there's the whole,
time.
You know, escaping from prison, blah, blah, blah. You know,
right.
So that's a little sequence right there. And then they float down the river and they end up in Lake Town.
Right.
And interacting with Lake Town, that'll be another sequence. And then they trek out to the mountain and they find the secret door, and that's another sequence.
Oh,
but,
spoilers, by the way, we should say that. Spoilers.
Okay, yes.
If you haven't
Lots
read
of
the
spoilers,
book,
right.
Stop
yes, if you haven't read
thing.
The book, put us on mute for, this will probably take us about 20 minutes to get through. No, just kidding.
Give us about 5 minutes. We'll be good.
Right, you know. But then, yes, Smaug figures out that they're around and comes out to try and kill them all and then goes and tries to burn down Lake Town, and one of the Lake Town guys manages to off Smaug.
Right.
So the death of Smaug might be the, you know, sort of ending point, you know, oh, we've sort of had a victory here for the end of the second movie.
Because
you know, cause after that, then, like, all the goblins come out and they actually have a pitched battle, you know, and that's probably going to be the big fight in the third movie.
Right.
You know.
So that's kind of what I figured, which I hadn't thought of. Like, you'd think, you know, the big Smaug thing is at the very end.
Right.
But really, it's got to be in the second movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could conceivably end the second movie with, you know, we have had a victory in, we've finally made it to the mountain.
I suppose.
But there's no fight. And, you know,
right.
Everybody knows Hollywood doesn't end a fantasy action movie without a big fight at the end.
Even if you have to completely create one like they did in The Hobbit.
Right, exactly.
Even if you have to pull one from the ether.
That doesn't really exist in the book. Right.
Right.
So I would anticipate, you know, if Hollywood is trying to follow their standard format of end the movie with a big fight, Smaug is going to come out and he'll try and burn down Lake Town, and the guy will shoot him with the arrow, and that will be the end of the
right.
the second movie.
You'd
and
think.
With a little bit of foreshadowing, oh, but there's a huge army of goblins that's
exactly.
coming.
Exactly,
you know?
Exactly. I just think that's got to happen. Anyway, though, that's yeah. a whole, that you can listen again, unspoiler. I'm waving my arms, but you can't see that.
Right.
But if we're done now, we're done ruining the movie for you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about Les Mis, a very different movie from The Hobbit.
Yes, very, also very known different. As that French singy song thing.
Right. Les Miserables, The Miserables, if you're my aunt who does not speak French at all.
I speak French, but it's the other kind of French.
Right, you know, the pardon my French kind of French.
Yes, exactly.
So anyway, it's this big, like, it's a huge, huge novel by Hugo, right?
I think, yes, Victor Hugo.
Yes.
Yes, because there were three French authors in total in the entirety of history.
Right.
Jules Verne, Alexandre Dumas, and Victor Hugo. And one of those three wrote this novel, because there's only three French novelists ever.
Right. Plus, no one made a musical out of Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Right, which actually, they've made movies out of it, and I think they might have been improved by
including
being
one Possibly. Starring Brendan Fraser, which is fun.
Drastic.
Exactly. Anytime Brendan Fraser is in a book based on an is in a movie based on a book, you should not watch that movie. I'm sorry.
Pretty much not.
Just don't. Just stay away from it. Anyway, though, so Les Mis, which was a big play, like, it's been around forever, this musical, which is not
right.
a musical, consequently, it is an opera. Musical is a complete misnomer, because musicals,
yeah.
how musicals work is there's, like, song, and then there's a talky bit, and then there's more singing. It's like The Sound of Music. That is a musical.
Right.
This
Where
is an
it's,
opera.
It's a long, engaged, dramatic plot, interspersed with occasional songs.
Right. Music,
Not,
is sort, no. music is sort of the exception to the rule,
right?
If you will. In Les Mis, it's all singing. Like there is
yes, they turned
like
on the camera
maybe,
and everybody started singing, and then once they stopped singing, they turned off the camera.
Right. Like there are maybe four spoken words in this entire thing.
Yes.
So anyway, it's a music. It is an opera, not a musical, and it is all about this dude who adopts a daughter. And there's a lot of singing, and then a lot of people dying. That's really, in Les Mis, the general rule is if they create a character you enjoy, that person will die shortly and tragically with a lot of tears and a small musical number.
Yes.
Given to themselves and their own death.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's like 3.5 hours long. Ish, 2.5. Sorry, oof.
Yeah.
2.5 hours long. It's a long movie. It's a long time. And one of my like I liked it. I thought it was an interesting experience. I thought this
right,
I thought
as
the
a,
story
you
was
know,
good.
If and especially if you're into the concept of, you know, performance and production and developing of
right.
theater and you know art of that sort, you know, it's a very ambitious project.
Right.
It's a very well done project, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean these people pulled out all the stops to make mm-hmm. something that is by anybody's account, very impressive. Even
right.
if you're not into opera or not into musicals or not into Broadway or not into film even, you have to admit, mm-hmm. Les Mis was impressive.
Right. Not into French people singing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I liked the story. I thought it was good. I thought, here's the thing with because a lot of people get all up in arms about the singing. Like they're like, Hugh Jackman turned in a bad performance. I'm putting air quotes around it, but you can't see. This is a problem. We need like an air quotes voice. I think there needs to be one of those because
bum bum bum.
Exactly.
Air
Hugh Jackman
quotes.
Bum ba da did not sing well. Okay. The thing is though, is that they did all the singing on the set. Like most musicals, how it works is you sing it on the set, and then you go into a recording studio where they like voice pitch change, and you know, like they have the ability to tweak your voice to make it sound perfect.
And then
they
overlay
there,
that
and then they overlay it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do that in this movie. They sang it on the set, which led to some really cool moments. So I felt like it was just a trade-off, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't think you can critique that without also saying, I wish that it had been, you know, this sort of fake experience like, you know, musicals have been for a long time.
Right. I refer you to every episode of Glee ever created.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I don't throw stones at that particular thing because I live in a glass house, so it's a bad idea.
Right.
It also makes, you know, taking a shower really awkward. Glass houses. As much as people in glass houses should not throw bricks, people in glass houses should not take showers.
They should change in the basement.
Exactly. It's awkward. Anyway, that's a side note. So anyway, Les Mis. decent film. I thought it was good. I thought it was long. My only problem really was there was no like break from the depression. Like it was like a long slog through mud, and it was just mud, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I thought it was impactful and it was sad, and that's okay, but there was like no break.
There was no relief.
Exactly. But
there was a tiny bit of relief. There was the Helena Bonham Carter, Sacha Baron Cohen innkeeper.
Those just annoyed me.
Which was supposed to be relief.
Yeah, those made me sadder because it was like, oh, this is supposed to be funny. And that made me sad again. It was actually worse. I felt worse about those scenes than when Fontaine or whatever.
Fontanelle.
Whoever. She died. Fanta.
Fatamin.
Yeah.
Fanta.
When she died.
That was her name.
When she dropped off, I was sad. And then when I was supposed to be laughing at Sacha Baron Cohen doing whatever in the world it was that he was doing, I was sadder. That hurt my heart. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on the whole thing?
I think personally, I would say the best performances, and this will be thrown in the face of every other critic that has weighed in apparently on this.
Mm-hmm.
I think Russell Crowe delivered a fantastic performance.
I agree.
And to give you guys a little bit of background, you know, he was the guy who played Javert,
right,
the villain of the piece, mm-hmm. And Javert is usually portrayed, especially on stage, as a, you know, sort of deep, resonant, mustache-twirling, you know, conniving villain who,
right,
is, you know, painted in the blackest hue,
right,
and that sort of thing. And
blackest
Russell Crowe's
the Hugh Jackman pun.
Right, yes. But yes. But when Russell Crowe portrayed it, he wasn't the best vocalist.
Right.
On the board. I mean, like, Hugh Jackman has done musical theater since he basically got started, you know?
Well, that's how he got started, was musical
theater. Right, yeah. You know, and most of the other main characters, you know, have a lot of music and musical theater in their background. Russell Crowe does not.
Mm-hmm.
The character that he played was simply, I felt he was much more sympathetic, which,
right,
you know, I enjoy a good sympathetic villain,
yeah,
because it makes it feel a little less cliche, you know,
mm-hmm,
when you know that everything the villain does is going to be terrible and evil, you know, then there are no surprises.
Right.
And you know, Russell Crowe's Javert was a man who was basically, you know, at the end of his rope because he was seeing that his personal philosophy of the law is always right and people who break the law are always bad. He's having to come to the realization that that's not always the case.
Right.
But he's built his life so fundamentally around that concept that once he realizes that that concept is flawed, he just has to commit suicide, which,
mm-hmm,
is a very French sort of thing to do.
No,
right. So I really enjoyed his, you know, kind of subtle, very relatable portrayal of the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, Anne Hathaway did an excellent job.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
You sympathized with her character, you know, as the quintessential victim of the piece, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hugh Jackman, of course, you know, does a fantastic job with the amount of passion that he's able to inject,
right,
in him. The characters that I thought could have been done much better were basically all of the young people.
I would agree with that, with the exception of, I thought Eponine, or Epona, the horse from,
yes,
Zelda, either one.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I thought
no.
she was great.
She was great, too. Yes.
Like,
I really liked her character.
Mm-hmm. Her song was great. I think it's a little retarded that in her mind, the only way to get someone to not fire a musket at someone is to aim that musket at yourself.
Right.
Which, because there's like this guy's about to shoot the boy that she has a crush on, and she grabs the musket and points it at herself.
Right.
And it's just,
you,
like,
couldn't have grabbed the musket and pointed it in,
right,
a different direction.
There are 360 degrees that you could have pointed that, and you chose yourself.
Your
but
own
you know,
guts. Right.
Whatever. Anyway, I thought her character was great.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mind her at all.
Right. But yeah, most of the, you know, students who were trying to, you know, engage this revolution to overthrow,
right,
the corrupt,
right,
government of France, you know, you're like, at no point in the movie do you ever really get the idea, why are you doing this?
Right.
You know, what is going on? I mean, yes, I can see, you know, France is starving. Okay. So instead of overthrowing the government, wouldn't instituting better agricultural policies be a little more effective?
Right.
Well, you
know, and then you've got the whole fact that their revolution, air quotes, revolution,
right,
consisted of six people and a mountain of chairs.
Right, in an hour. In front of a bar.
It seems like we could have planned this better, you know? Like we're supposed to be the young great minds of France, and that's our evolution. It seems like
military strategy
planning
was not something we went in on.
Exactly. Like, you know, it seems like we really could have read a book on how to overthrowing your country for dummies. Someone must have written that in ancient France, because it happened every other day. Everyone overthrew the ancient French government.
The French Revolution is not just an event. It is like a, you know, 50-year bits and pieces here and there, and then finally somebody woke up one day and said, all right, we've had enough of this. Let's just have a democracy.
Exactly. For 50 years in France, people who were bored on weekends overthrew the French government. Like, it just sort of happened. So it seems to me like these four people and their mountain of chairs could have looked at, you know, the revolution that happened, say, a month ago and been like, oh, we should do it
that way.
That's
what they did wrong.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's, I mean, you know, and, you know, so the plot and the motivation and some of the portrayals of those young revolutionaries, you know, they were, I think it was really they got drunk over a weekend and decided to overthrow the government. You know, that's really what it came across as, you know, and then one guy got a crush on another girl and that kind of threw the whole thing, threw a wrench in the works of the whole thing.
I really feel like that love story in that book is very telling of where we've come as a culture. Because, all right, Victor Hugo wrote this in, like, you know, the year of Ferdinand in 1800-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like, a long time ago, basically. And he writes a story, and these two people who have never met, ever, make eye contact for 2 seconds, and they fall in love forever. And then you've got the girl who's been with this guy forever, Epona, or Eponine, or whatever it is, who, you know, really loves him. Like, there's genuine love there. And in a modern love story, what's his name, the idiot, falls in love with Eponine. But because this is Victor Hugo writing in, you know, French time before France had French bread, he wrote it that these two people who've never met before ever, who are idiots, fall in love with each other.
Right. It's this like fated destiny kind of thing.
Right. And I just don't think it meshes with modern culture. It's like Romeo and Juliet. Right. Like, you know, people who watch that play just don't get it anymore because they're like, mm-hmm. well, this is stupid. They just met.
Exactly.
That's just not how we do romance anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But back in those times, you know, I mean, marriages were constantly arranged, you know.
Exactly.
You would marry somebody that you might have met like 3 times before.
Right.
And
so you almost had to believe.
Yeah. You had to approach a relationship as, you know, hey, I've decided I'm going to do this, even though I don't really know this person, and they might be the type of person that constantly watches SpongeBob every weekend.
Exactly.
You know?
Your life became that song, Do You Love Me, from Fiddler on the Roof. Like, that was you.
Yes.
There you go. That was an obscure reference. So
well
for those of you
well
who have not watched Fiddler on the Roof, go watch it. It's a good film, though long. That's another.
Also,
that's like
a
3.5-hour long movie. There. Good lord. You watch that, you're like camping out for a day and a half.
I've known people who have graduated college in the time that it took to watch Fiddler on the Roof.
Right. The great thing about Fiddler on the Roof is it's cut into the first half, which is great and awesome, and like this really funny, self-aware look at Judaism, and the second half, which is just depressing. Like, the second half, everybody dies or catches influenza, and then they all have to move. That is a summarization of the second half of Fiddler on the Roof. For those of you who have not seen it. That said, I recommend it.
Yeah, no, we recommend it, and, you know, I mean, because it does have those elements of comic relief, especially towards the beginning, which Les Mis was lacking. Les Mis was like watching, it was like a 2.5-hour version of the first 5 minutes of Up.
It's very true. Oh, my goodness. What were the people at Disney Pixar thinking? No. Because I went to watch Up after it had come out on DVD, and everyone was like, oh, this is such a great movie. It's so funny, blah, 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 blah. I was devastated. Like, after the first 5 minutes, I was done. I was out. Like, I don't care how funny
the sun will never rise again.
Exactly. Because she was dead. It's like this whole thing of, oh, we're taking a journey and we arrive. And at the end of the movie, they're sitting there on their house on a hill and whatever. But the fact is that she is still dead.
Yes.
Like, that ruined the whole film for me. I was done after that.
Right.
Because I mean, sat there and pondered.
It's like they're trying to pass off the concept, if your wife dies, kidnap an Asian kid and find a stray dog. You'll be fine.
Exactly. Like, the whole rest of the film was just done at that point. That's a very good summarization. Les Mis is like a 2.5 hour version of the beginning of Up. There you go. Somebody put that on the back of the DVD. The back of the Les Mis DVD. That needs to be on there from Jack and Micah. All right. Well, that was great. That's all we have for today. Thank you so much for listening. Check out thoughtswemighthavehad.com.
Absolutely.
Hit a link on there and look up Jack's website, Alt F4. It's all very cool. Thank you guys so much for listening.
We'll be back later
next week.